Welcome to another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast, brought to you by Courtroom Sciences. Dr. Steve Wood, coming to you from a hotel room, more of an impromptu podcast based upon some things I've been seeing recently that I wanted to get on and talk a little bit about. You know, on the podcast, we talk a lot about witness preparation, witness training, and a lot of it is focused on training and preparation for depositions. You know, as we know, a lot of cases go to trial, so a lot of the focus tends to be on how witnesses are going to perform in their depositions. But I think what happens sometimes is it gets overlooked is preparing those witnesses for trial, because as we always talked about is that what it takes to be a good witness in a deposition is much different than what it takes to be a good witness at trial. And I think sometimes those facts get missed or witnesses aren't being prepared properly to make sure that they have more of a focus on the trial aspect. So what I wanted to talk to you today is more about trial preparation. First thing right out of the gate is, you know, we talk as far as it goes in the deposition about kind of taking your time to process the question before you respond. Same thing at trial, we're going to want witnesses on cross-examination to take their time to think and process to make sure that they truly hear the question. But on direct examination, it's awfully important too for witnesses to take the time before they respond, and for several reasons. First of all, they want to make sure that they understand and process the question from their own counsel. They want to make sure that they're not answering too quickly for, you know, the friendly fire questions when their attorney's asking the question, but then they're taking this long pause when opposing counsel is asking the question, because jurors will then notice the difference between the two of them, because, you know, they're going to think, all right, well, you were answering so quick when your attorney was asking questions, but when opposing counsel is asking you questions, you slow down and take your time because you're trying to make things up or you're trying to make sure you don't step in it. So witnesses need to have consistency in the time that they're taking to answer questions both on cross and direct. The other reason why taking time is important for a witness is that jurors are going to be hearing this information for the first time. You know, the attorneys, the witnesses, and all the people that are involved in the case have lived the case, they know the case facts, and they're not hearing it for the first time versus the jury who is hearing it for the first time. So if those questions, there's rapid fire answers to those questions and jurors haven't really had a time to understand what's even being asked, then they're gonna get lost in the back and forth of the yep, as all the answers are coming rapid fire. So witnesses wanna take the time not only to make sure that they give a good answer, but to make sure that the jurors are following along with the question that's being asked. Because as I always tell witnesses, jurors are ultimately the only ones who have the votes. Jurors are the ones that you want to make sure are following along. And if you can do that, they'll appreciate the fact that you're not only concerned about answering the question, but you're also concerned about making sure that they are following along with the answer you're giving. Along that lines, you know, short, concise responses. We talk about short, concise responses in depositions, awfully important in trial as well. Not only because the fact that you don't want to give long-winded responses that allow opposing counsel to open doors and start asking additional questions, you know, on direct examination, you also want to have short, concise responses because once again, jurors are hearing the information for the first time. And if you're giving this minute to minute and a half response to every single question, you know, as Bill has talked about in papers before, and we've talked about on the podcast, the idea of primacy and recency effect. Right? Primacy being that you remember things that happened earlier, recency that you have a memory that's better memory for things that happened later. But what happens is in that somewhere in the middle, that information ends up being lost. So if you're given a long minute, minute and a half response, there may be good pieces of information in there that are being lost because jurors can't track for that long. So the short, concise responses also become important to make sure you're hitting your points as you're giving your testimony, versus giving a long-winded response that jurors may miss some key pieces of information. Another thing, look at the jury when you're giving responses. Now, obviously, we don't want to have it look like a ping pong match where it's question answer, where every time you're looking at the attorney as they're asking a question, then you give a short yes to the jury. We don't want that. You know, I think if the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial taught us anything, was that there was a stark difference between how Johnny Depp addressed the jury, how Johnny Depp addressed his answers versus how Amber Heard did, where she was constantly looking at the jury, almost to a point where it made them uncomfortable. So there's got to be a delicate balance between looking at the jury too much and not looking at them enough. So that's one of the things your witnesses need to understand, is that when you have an opportunity, when you have the time to give an explanation, turn, look at the jury, make eye contact with them, engage, and make sure that they are a part of the story. Because once again, at the end of the day, they're the ones whose votes really matter. One other thing I want to talk about too, about corporate reps or witnesses in general. I think sometimes there's not enough time placed on providing the documents, preparing these witnesses for what did you say in your deposition? What are the key documents that you're probably going to get shown? You know, how are we going to handle these different issues? Because what ends up happening is sometimes witnesses are seeing documents for the first time, and then it might be an inflammatory document. It might be one that would be more of a quote unquote dangerous document that has bad facts for our case. And the juror or the witness is seeing it for the first time in front of the jury. And then all of a sudden now that emotional reaction happens, they start going into fight or flight, they have amygdala hijack. And then rather than just answering the question calm, cool, and collected, they want to yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, or no, because, no, because, no, because, pivot all over the place, because it's one of the first times, if the only time, that they've seen that document. So I think there needs to be time on the front end prior to testimony to make sure your witnesses have read their deposition and reread their deposition so that they know they can stick to what was said in the deposition to reduce the chances of them trying to have, you know, their testimony and be impeached by what they said at deposition and what they said at trial. I see that way too often where witnesses just don't know what was in their deposition and then try to testify at trial differently than what they did. So check the documents. And then, like I said, go through the documents so that the first time they're seeing it, it's not at trial. Another thing, pivoting. You know, on the podcast, we're big anti-pivoting people. You know, if the answer is yes, the answer is yes. Yes, period. Move on. Don't try to offer up all these long-winded explanations, because in a deposition, it's bad because, you know, the opposing counsel doesn't really care about your explanation, and opposing counsel is going to more than likely object that it is non-responsive, accuse you of using that opportunity to provide self-serving testimony. And it's not helpful, right? And you open up more doors to extend your deposition. At trial, it's a similar type of thing. You know, you give a yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. And then what ends up happening, once again, opposing counsel says it's, you know, non-responsive. They identify in front of the jury and try to pull out the fact in front of the jury that you're trying to be evasive and that you're not trying to answer the question. And maybe you are, maybe you aren't. But the point being is opposing counsel is going to make a big issue of it and draw the attention to the juries that you're being evasive, which from a witness perspective, especially a corporate representative, is really going to hurt their credibility, because now it looks like you can't answer a simple yes or no question because you want to add all that self-serving information. You know, as I always tell witnesses, there's a time and a place, and you'll have an opportunity to get your explanation, and you might not get it on cross-exam, you know, depending on whether you're being, you know, called adversely or whether or not you're being called in your attorney's case in chief. But the point being is you may not have a chance on cross-examination to get your explanation out, but you're going to have a point at some time to be able to do it. And you need to wait for that point, because if you try to jam it in there, it looks like you can't answer a simple question. And one of the worst things you can do is pivot and kill your credibility. And last, this is really less about witness training and more about just general jury selection. What I've seen lately now is attorneys saying, especially on the defense side, saying, I want smart jurors because smart jurors are defense jurors. As if somehow insinuating that plaintiff jurors are stupid, defense jurors are smart. And I would tell you that if that's the way you're approaching your jury selection, you're opening yourself up for, you know, a possibility of putting a bad juror on there. Because you could have a juror who has very articulate PhD, master's level, you know, speak very well when they're giving their responses. The problem is if they have a lot of other pro plaintiff markers, then when they get on the jury, now what you have is someone who's pro plaintiff. And now what you have is someone who can articulate their arguments, who has took good notes, who can remember a lot of things. But what ends up happening then is those other jurors who may not be as intelligent, who may not have followed the case as closely, now all of a sudden they're going to fall in line with the individual who they believe is a lot more intelligent or as a leader to them. So what could end up happening is it can backfire on you. So getting these smart jurors on there could actually bring you up from a defense perspective and have a higher verdict, because you put someone on there because you thought that they were, because they were smart, they were going to side with you, and you're absolutely wrong. So as I always say before, if there's a wild card on the jury, you better make sure that they're your wild card. And if you're not, you better get them off. Because like I said, the last thing you want is someone who's a strong leader who's going to vote against you. That's all I really got. I was going to keep it short. This is kind of a brief one that just came up, but I thought it was too important for me to not mention it on the podcast. We'll be back with a more full-length podcast coming in the future, but that's all I got today. As always, go to courtroomsciences.com, podcast, blogs, all of that's up there. Feel free to reach out to me, swood@courtroomsciences.com, via LinkedIn, or just reach out to me via email. Always happy to talk. Thanks again to all our listeners. And this has been another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast brought to you by Courtroom Sciences.